Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
My next question for you was, have you seen or heard about the film The Help? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, as my first thought, as soon as I heard about The Help, it's similar to the thought I had about planking. I'm looking at a picture of some black guy planking now and laying face down on top of some wheels. They said it started in Australia. I have the same thought, and that is that white people are going back to the old ways of doing things. They're taking this help. Somehow they've taken a movie. Now, I'm not going to see the movie. They're not getting a dime from me. But somehow they've taken the subjugation and exploitation of black women in lazy white women's houses and turned it into some kind of noble endeavor. From what I see is them trying to portray the kind of work that black women used to do as okay. Because that's where they want to push us back to. They want us back to. See, a lot. This is just my theory. A lot of the Mexicans, believe it or not, are going home. The climate here is becoming more hostile. The economy in Mexico is actually better for a lot of them than it is here. So the Mexicans are going home. Who's going to clean the lazy white women's houses now? Who's going to plant the crops? Black people got to be aware. There's black people working in the fields as we speak. There's black people on plantations in Mississippi and Louisiana working like slaves. There are black prisoners in Angola prison in Louisiana, and you can hardly find these articles anymore, that are actually working on the same land, planting cotton on the same exact land that their slave ancestors planted cotton. I'm talking about the year 2009. So what I'm saying is, white people, as Dr. Wellesley says, are going back to the old ways of doing things. What does that really mean? Does that mean black women who are losing jobs are going to be relegated back to cleaning lazy white women's houses? I say yes. I say, are black people going to be taken? See, the clock never went forward. We just thought it did. But the appearance of the clock changed. But in reality, they're going back to the old ways of doing things. I think that's a way of, like, the planking thing. And I don't know what the planking thing is, but let's assume that it is something to do with slavery. You're making a mockery of slavery. Well, when you get black women making movies where black women are laughing and giggling with a bunch of lazy white women as they clean their houses, what is that really saying? That's saying that, hey, cleaning houses ain't as bad as you think. Look, you actually can have fun doing this. I believe that they're going to try to, with the economy being bad, black people, if we're not careful, I don't know how careful we can be, because a lot of this is out of our control, but I think we're going to see black people relegated to doing the same kind of labor that our grandfathers and grandmothers did. And we need to pay attention to that, because I believe that's what these, in every movie they put out here, in my opinion, it's a movie showing you about how racism and white supremacy really function, what white people are really thinking. And I don't think The Help is any different. Just the way I saw it, I just saw it as, once again, I'm trying to elevate the white black women cleaning lazy white women's houses to some kind of acceptable activity.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 7th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our second study session on Pamela Evans Harris. The second book that she co-authored, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We are picking up recipe number 2, 500 Years of Justice Denied. That'll be page 53, going right into chapter 9. That's what we're picking up at this week. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was from Pam the Great, her visit in August of 2011. That's a few months after this book was first published. She came on to talk about that text again specifically. And a caller asked her about the film The Help, which I think applies in a myriad of ways to what's going to be covered in the portions of the reading today. Without further ado, we will get to Pam the Great. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, narrated by one of our investors at the Cows, doing a fantastic job. This is audio segment number 1.
Recipe number 2, 500 Years of Justice Denied. Chapter 9, 500 Years of Justice Denied. If the Jews were compensated for 12 years of injustice, and the Japanese were compensated for 3 years of injustice, should the descendants of slaves be compensated for 400 years of slavery? Let the facts speak for themselves. Quote, I never know what it was to rest. I just worked all the time from morning to late at night. I had to do everything there was to do on the outside, work in the field, chop wood, hoe corn, till sometimes I feel like my back surely break. I done everything except split rails. End quote. Sarah Gudger, former slave from Burke County, North Carolina. Fact: American slavery did not end with the Emancipation Proclamation of 1865. After the Emancipation Proclamation was signed into law and legal slavery officially ended, the slave led South created new laws to overturn the rights of free blacks to make up for the loss of free labor. Thousands of black men were falsely arrested and forced to work for free on prison chain gangs. Free black men dug dishes, built America's railroads, laid railroad tracks, and picked crops for wealthy white farmers. America's chain gang prisoners were mostly black males who put in 16-hour days wearing 20-pound leg iron. Rancid food, malnutrition, and shackle poisoning caused by the chains rubbing against their shackled ankles killed hundreds of prisoners each year. Chain gangs were abolished around 1955, almost 100 years after the end of slavery, but slavery never ended on the back roads of America. Black slavery in the year 2010. Quote, blacks don't want to believe this, slavery, is happening in 2010, but black people are forced to stay on plantations in Glendora, Mississippi, Webb, Mississippi, Roseland, Louisiana, and other places where white landowners use isolation and threats of violence to keep these black workers under control. End quote. Antoinette Harrell, a black female researcher and genealogist, who has been tracking modern-day slavery for a decade. Source, thefinalcall.com. Blacks picking cotton at Louisiana's Angola prison in 2008. Quote, on an expanse of 18,000 acres of farmland, 59 miles northwest of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, long rows of men, mostly African-American, till the fields under the hot Louisiana sun. The men pick cotton, wheat, soybeans, and corn. They work for pennies, literally. Armed guards, mostly white, ride up and down the roads on horseback, keeping watch. The farm is called Angola, after the homeland of the slaves who first worked its soil. Source, Maya Shrinwar, www.truthout.org. Fact, slavery existed in the North and the South. Contrary to the myth that slavery only existed in the South, the center of slave trading in the North was New England's old colonies. While slavery never reached the numbers it did in the South, slaves were publicly auctioned in Philadelphia, Rhode Island, Virginia, New Jersey, Maryland, and New York. The evidence. Runaway slave advertisements as they appeared in print in colonial papers in the North. The Boston Newsletter, July 23, 1716, quote, "This is to give notice that on 16th of July, 1716, runaway from his master David Lyell, an Indian man named Nim, he lately belonged to Mr. James Moore. He is about 1 and 20 years of age, and his short, broad shoulders, fellow, his hair hath lately been cut off. He has a swelling on the back of his right hand and can do something in the carpenter's trade. He hath with him 2 new shirts, a new waistcoat, and breeches of white coarse linen, and the same blue striped, a homespun coat, wears a hat, shoes, stockings. 'Tis believed he endeavors to get on board some vessel. Whoever takes up the said Indian in the Jerseys and brings him to his said master shall have 40 shillings and charges, and if in any other government, 5 pounds if they give but notice where he is, so that his master may have him again. Direct to David Lyell in New York." End quote. The American Weekly Mercury, November 15, 1722, quote, "Runaway from William Yard of Trenton in New Jersey, the 5th day of this instant November, a Negro man named French Manuel, but commonly called Manuel, of a pretty tall stature, and speaks indifferent English. He wears a dark-colored homespun coat, an Ozenbrig jacket, old leather breeches, sheep russet stockings, new shoes, and an old beveret hat. He pretended formerly to be a free man and had passes, but he did belong to one John Raymond of Fairfield in New England, and I bought him of said Raymond. And the said Negro boy has told since he has run away. Whoever takes up the said Negro, secures him, and brings him to Mr. William Bradford of New York, or to Mr. William Burge of Philadelphia, or to his said master at Trenton, shall have 40 shillings reward, beside all reasonable charges paid by me, William Yard." End quote. The American Weekly Mercury, May 1, 1729, quote, "These are to be given notice that on the first day of this instant, May 1729, was taken up a Negro man about 43 years of age and put into the gaol at Burlington for stealing from several persons sundry sorts of goods. The Negro man saith he belongs to one Roger Matthews, living in Baltimore County in Maryland. The said Negro man formerly belonged to Governor Markham and was sold down at Maryland by Mr. Rainier, attorney at law." End quote. Even Abraham Lincoln's family owned slaves. Fact, 90% of slaves lived on plantations and farms and labored from sunup to sundown, providing skilled and unskilled labor on plantations in the South and contributing to the labor demands of the North. Quote, "The conch shell blowed afore daylight, and all hands better get out for roll call, or Solomon bust the door down and get them out. It was work hard, get beatings, and have fed. They brung the victuals, food, and water to the fields on the side pulled by an old mule. Plenty times there were only a half barrel water and it's stale and hot. for all us niggas on the hottest days. Mostly, we ate pickled pork and cornbread and peas and beans and taters. They never was as much as we needed. The times I hated most was picking cotton when the frost was on the boils. My hands get sore and crack open and bleed. We'd have a little fire in the fields, and if in the ones with tender hands couldn't stand it no longer, we'd run and warm our hands a little bit. End quote. Mary Reynolds, former slave, interviewed in the 1930s. Fact. Slaves were literally worked to death. New York City, 1991. Construction workers digging a foundation for a skyscraper unearthed an 18th century slave graveyard, revealing the remains of 427 bodies. African Americans waged a fierce political fight to preserve the site as a sacred place. After losing the battle and after months of negotiation, the skeletons were sent to Washington, D.C.'s Howard University for examination by biological anthropologists. The startling conclusion? African slaves not only built early New York, they were literally worked to death while doing it. Half the bodies found were children, many infants under 6 months old. The high infant mortality rate tells researchers that the living conditions of enslaved Africans were inhumane. After scientists at Cobb Laboratory studied the defects in muscle attachments and fractures on the remains of the buried slaves, they concluded that slaves were pressed to the very margins of human physical capacity. Fact. Slaves demanded compensation for their labor. Slaves were not the brainless mass of subhumanity that Western history books and Hollywood films depicted. Many slaves were well aware of the value of their labor. At the end of the Civil War, some demanded compensation for creating so much wealth for the white slave owners. Quote, "We has a right to the land where we are located. Our wives, our children, our husbands has been sold over and over again to purchase the lands we now locate upon. That's the reason we have a divine right to the land. Didn't we clear the land and raise the crops of corn, of cotton, of tobacco, of rice, of sugar, of everything?" End quote. From a speech in 1866. By former slave Bailey Wyatt at Yorktown, Virginia, on behalf of freedmen's land claims. Abraham Lincoln, emancipator or racist manipulator. Quote, "I will say then that I am not nor ever have been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not nor ever have been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. I say upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, the Negro should be denied everything." End quote. Abraham Lincoln, 1809 through 1965. Chapter 10, Willie Lynch Notwithstanding. Contrary to the Willie Lynch legend, slavery alone is not responsible for the conditions of blacks today. Even 400 years of brutality and murder could not extinguish the resilient African spirit. During and after chattel slavery, blacks greatly valued our family units. Newly freed slaves traveled thousands of miles to find loved ones, spouses, and children. We had a strong sense of community, and in some areas, geographically and socially, we surpassed whites. We ran for political office and won, since blacks were the majority of registered voters in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Former slaves started businesses that rivaled and often exceeded those of whites and were patronized by black and white customers. However, this brief period of freedom and prosperity for newly freed slaves came to a screeching halt for the following reasons. The Reconstruction Era, 1865 through 1877. In the aftermath of the Civil War, the South, which was heavily dependent on slave labor, was in shambles. To solve this problem, President Andrew Johnson, a former slave owner, gave Southern whites all the power to define freedom for former slaves. Blacks, who had been promised freedom after fighting in the Civil War for that freedom, were denied any say in the process. When these new governments passed the Black Codes in 1865, the rights of former slaves as free citizens, as defined by the U.S. Constitution, were abolished. They had no legal rights, no right to own land, and were forbidden from working and earning the same as whites. Even though land was in plentiful supply, newly freed slaves were forced back to the plantations to work as sharecroppers for former plantation owners, and had to buy seed, tools, and supplies from the landlords. This new form of slavery, which in some parts in the South still exists, allowed former slave owners to grow rich off the labor of blacks and guaranteed a life of hardship and poverty for former slaves and their descendants. The Black Codes, 1865. To control the labor, migration, and freedoms of newly freed slaves, the Southern states passed laws known as the Black Codes, which were put into effect immediately after the Civil War to ensure cheap black slave labor would remain in plentiful supply. Examples of Black Codes after slavery ended. Mississippi. Negroes must make annual contracts for their labor in writing. If they should run away from their tasks, they forfeited their wages for the year. Whenever required, they must present licenses in town from the mayor, elsewhere from a member of the Board of Police of the Beat, citing their places of residence and authorizing them to work. Fugitives from labor were to be arrested and carried back to their employers. Minors were to be apprenticed, if males, until they were 21, if females, until 18 years of age. Such corporal punishment as a father would administer to a child might be inflicted upon apprentices by their masters. Negroes might not carry knives or firearms unless they were licensed to do so. It was an offense punishable by a fine of $50. An imprisonment for 30 days to give or sell intoxicating liquors to a Negro. When Negroes could not pay the fines and costs after legal proceedings, they were to be hired at public outcry by the sheriff to the lowest bidder. South Carolina. In South Carolina, persons of color contracting for service were to be known as servants, and those with whom they contracted as masters. On farms, the hours of labor would be from sunrise to sunset daily, except on Sunday. The Negroes were to get out of bed at dawn. Time lost would be deducted from their wages, as would be the cost of food, nursing, etc., during absence from sickness. Absentees on Sunday must return to the plantation by sunset. House servants were to be at call at all hours of the day and night on all days of the week. Illinois. Laws were passed to discourage blacks from coming to Illinois. Blacks were denied the right to vote and denied most rights given to white men. Blacks required a certificate of freedom to travel between the states and had to register that certificate or suffer the fate of the runaway slaves, which could be a sentence of 35 lashes. Blacks were forbidden from assembling in groups of three or more, could be jailed and whipped. The Black Law of 1853, no black person from another state could stay in Illinois for more than 10 days or was subject to arrest, a fine, a jail term, and removal from the state. If the offender was unable to pay the fine, the sheriff could auction the offender to a white bidder willing to pay the fine in exchange for free labor. The black codes drew public outrage from the hypocritical North, which had passed its own discriminatory laws against blacks. In 1866, the South was put under military rule. New elections were held. Blacks and poor whites were allowed to vote, and the new government repealed all the black codes. In reality, former slaves were still bound by the black codes, which are still in effect today. Jim Crow, 1876 through 1965. Jim Crow was a set of state and local laws in the United States created to replace the repealed black codes that mandated separate but unequal status for all blacks in America. Jim Crow laws remained in effect from 1876 to 1965 and were designed to turn freed slaves into permanent non-citizens, slaves. Examples of Jim Crow laws. Alabama. All passenger stations in the state operated by any motor transportation company shall have separate waiting rooms and separate ticket windows for the white and the colored races. Georgia. All persons licensed to conduct a restaurant shall serve either white people exclusively or colored people exclusively, and shall not sell to the two races within the same room or serve the two races anywhere under the same license. Louisiana. Any person who shall rent any part of any such building to a Negro place or a Negro family when such building is already in whole or in part in occupancy by a white person or white family, or vice versa when the building is in occupancy by a Negro person or Negro family, shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. Maine. A constitutional amendment was passed in 1893 requiring electors to be able to read the Constitution in English and write his name. Since slaves were not allowed to learn to read or write, this requirement prevented most blacks from voting. Maryland. All railroad companies and corporations and all persons running or operating cars or coaches by steam on any railroad line or track in the state of Maryland for the transportation of passengers are hereby required to provide separate cars or coaches for the travel and transportation of the white and colored passengers. North Carolina. Books shall not be interchangeable between the white and colored schools, but shall continue to be used by the race first using them. The state librarian is directed to fit up and maintain a separate place for the use of the colored people who may come to the library for the purpose of reading books or periodicals. The psychological wages of whiteness. Quote, it must be remembered that the white group of laborers, while they received a low wage, were compensated in part by a sort of public and psychological wage. They were given public deference and title of courtesy because they were white. They were admitted freely with all classes of white people to public functions, public parks, and the best schools. The police were drawn from their ranks and the courts depended on their vote, treated them with such leniency as to encourage lawlessness. Their vote selected public officials, and while this had small effect upon the economic situation, It had great effect upon their personal treatment and the deference shown them. White schoolhouses were the best in the community and conspicuously placed, and they had cost anywhere from twice to 10 times as much per capita as the colored schools. The newspapers specialized in news that flattered the poor whites and almost utterly ignored the Negro, except in crime and ridicule. End quote. Black Reconstruction in America, W.B. Du Bois, 1935. Honorary whites kept blacks in their place. Quote, the Irish, who at home readily sympathize with the oppressed everywhere, are instantly taught when they step upon our soil to hate and despise the Negro. Sir, the Irish American will one day find out his mistake. End quote. Frederick Douglass, May 10, 1853. In the first half of the 19th century, over 3 million Irish immigrated to America to escape the potato famine, 1845 through 1855, and oppression at the hands of the Anglo-Irish Anglicans. The penal laws used against the oppressed Irish Catholics in Ireland were similar to the black codes against blacks in America. The desperately poor Irish immigrants were the most despised of all free laborers. They had no skills, and although they spoke the English language, the vast majority could not read or write it. Since they were not seen as white by the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASP, elites, Irish immigrants were forced to labor side by side with blacks or worked as overseers on slave plantations. This closeness may explain why so many blacks have Irish last names, such as Smith, Murphy, Moore, Boyce, Butler, and Banks. In contrast, most slaves were forced to learn a trade and were the master builders, carpenters, iron workers, farmers, seamstresses, and cooks that provided most of the skilled labor in the South, the same skilled slave labor that built the White House. To keep free blacks in an inferior position, the WASPs struck a deal with the Irish, the largest immigrant group in America. In exchange for being white, the Irish had to embrace racism and serve as the foot soldiers of the white supremacy elite. In return, the Irish were rewarded with monopolies on the most dangerous blue-collar jobs, fire, police, and construction, and were paid a generous wage to ensure they would always be more prosperous than blacks. The predominantly Irish police force became a tool of the white elite to intimidate and terrorize blacks to keep them from rebelling against a racist system. Blatant police abuses against blacks served another purpose. It was visible proof to the lower caste whites that even while they were being exploited, they were still more privileged and superior to blacks. This cemented their loyalty to an economic system that allowed even the poorest whites to feel superior. One only has to check the ethnic roster of most major city, fire, police, and construction unions, their resistance to blacks joining the trade unions, police, and fire departments, and today's rampant police brutality against blacks to see the deal between the white elites and their honorary white foot soldiers is still in effect. The Ku Klux Klan, KKK. Founded in 1865 in Pulaski, Tennessee by Confederate Army veterans, the losers of the Civil War, the KKK terrorized, robbed, raped, and murdered blacks to keep them in their place and was largely successful, especially in the South. Black Wall Street, 1908 through 1921. Despite the relentless violence and oppression against former slaves, blacks made phenomenal gains shortly after legal slavery ended. The land run of 1880 allowed blacks to acquire free land, and many former slaves fled the South and took advantage of this unique opportunity. From 1865 to 1920, Oklahoma had over 50 independently functioning all-black towns. These all-black towns were an oasis for blacks from the brutal racism found in racially mixed parts of the country. According to Arthur Tolson, a historian of blacks in Oklahoma, many blacks turned to ideologies of economic advancement, self-help, and racial solidarity. The most famous example was Tulsa, Oklahoma, better known as Black Wall Street, an all-black town that boasted a thriving business district, a bus line, 21 restaurants, a library, a bank, a hospital, 21 churches, 2 movie theaters, a newspaper, excellent schools, a half dozen private airplanes, law offices, and a post office. This was an amazing feat for a people just a few decades from being slaves. Unfortunately, Black Wall Street drew the wrath of less prosperous white towns. An envious white mob, fueled by the fictitious story of a black boy raping a white girl, and aided by the KKK, the law, less enforcement, and the U.S. military, looted and firebombed the all-black town from the air. Over 3,000 black men, women, and children were murdered. 12 hours after one of the worst race riots in U.S. history, Black Wall Street was no more. The Great Depression dealt the final death blow to most all-black towns, and blacks began to migrate west and north to find employment. The white rape victim later confirmed she had not been raped after all. Massive injuries on top of massive injuries. Jim S. is walking down a dark country road when he is struck by a hit-and-run driver and sustains serious injuries. He crawls into the road to get help, but it is pitch black outside. The bus driver doesn't see him until it is too late and Jim is run over by the bus. Jim was not destroyed by the first set of injuries. He was young and strong, and had he received the help and the time he needed to heal, he would have survived his injuries. However, a second set of equally devastating injuries on top of his unhealed injuries effectively sealed Jim's fate. If slavery had destroyed African slaves, there would have been no need for whites to create the Black Code or Jim Crow laws. Had the former slaves been allowed to heal from the damage caused by slavery without sabotage from whites, they could have completely recovered from slavery. However, 150 years of post-slavery racism literally threw the descendants of former slaves under the bus. If whites had not had 500 years of superior educational, economic, and social advances, they would not be in a superior position over blacks. Perhaps it is this secret knowledge in the hearts of whites collectively that continues to fuel today's racism. If former slaves were able to build a Black Wall Street only 3 decades after slavery, one could only imagine what Black America could have become without any racist interference and sabotage. It is highly possible and highly probable there would have been thousands of prosperous, independently run Black cities all over America. Chapter 11, Do Blacks Deserve Reparations? Quote, "The fact is, you can't brutalize a people massively and then just tell them to get over it. That will never work, just as it would never work in our personal lives." End quote. Donna Lamb, CURE, Caucasians United for Reparations and Emancipation. The idea of reparations for slavery is nothing new. Neither is the outrage against racist injustice and oppression. Walker's Appeal, published September 1829. In 1829, David Walker, a black slave, published Walker's Appeal, a 76-page pamphlet that condemned white Christians for not opposing racism and slavery. Walker encouraged slaves to rebel by any means necessary, including violence, in order to win their freedom. In his appeal, Walker stated that blacks suffered more than any other people in the history of the world did. Quote, "The whites have had us under them for more than three centuries, murdering and treating us like brutes." End quote. Walker's appeal identified four causes for the wretchedness of slaves. Slavery, a submissive and cringing attitude towards whites, even among free blacks. Indifference by Christian ministers, and false help by groups such as the American Colonization Society, which promised freedom from slavery only on the condition that freed blacks would be forced to leave America for the colonies in West Africa. Walker vigorously opposed the idea of leaving a country that was built on the backs of slaves. Quote, "Let no man of us budge one step, and let slaveholders come to beat us from our country. America is more our country than it is the whites. We have enriched it with our blood and tears. The greatest riches in all America have arisen from our blood and tears, and they will drive us from our property and homes, which we have earned with our blood." End quote. Unfortunately, Walker didn't live long enough to see slavery abolished. He was mysteriously poisoned, allegedly, by whites. Black Manifesto, 1969. Quote, "If we can't sit at the table of democracy, let us knock the fucking legs off," end quote. James Forman, black civil rights leader and author of the Black Manifesto, 1969. As part of his Black Manifesto, James Forman demanded $500 million in reparations and a percentage of the assets from white churches and other racist institutions to make up for injustices blacks had suffered over the centuries. The original 10-point program demands outlined in his manifesto, quote, "We call for the establishment of a Southern land bank to help our brothers and sisters who had to leave their land because of racist pressure and for people who want to establish cooperative farms but who have no funds. We have seen too many farmers evicted from their homes because they have dared to defy the white racism of this country. We need money for land. We must fight for massive sums of money for the Southern Land Bank. We call for $200 million to implement this program." End quote. Why We Owe Them by Carol Shahadi, Cure. Caucasians United for Reparations and Emancipation. Quote, "Stop living in the past and move on after slavery. This is what we often tell African Americans. Well, we certainly forced them to move on. We moved on black codes, Jim Crow, lynching, de facto segregation. We moved on to white knights hiding behind ghosts of themselves while religiously lighting crosses in praises of a Satan they were fooled into thinking was God. We moved on to the cities of Tulsa, St. Louis, and Rosewood, where we apparently were unaffected by the burned and seared flesh of black people. We've moved on to laws that upheld racial oppression over and over again. We moved on to the many black men placed on death row because they fit the description. We moved on and made sure that Emmett Till would not be the last 14-year-old black child whose unrecognizable corpse was the price paid for supposedly whistling at a white woman. We've moved on to exclude African Americans from the rights of democracy by blocking avenues to employment, education, housing, and civil rights. In the final decade of the last century, the slow, consistent racial apocalypse started showing signs of even more things to come when a black man's head was seen rolling behind a pickup truck in Jasper, Texas. By the time we racially profiled our way from Texas to New York, we find a city plagued with plungers and 41 bullets. Every time black people have tried leaving the shackles of slavery behind, we find that we were the ones that couldn't stop living in the past. End quote. Let no man budge one step. Ray W., 48, was having his usual lunch, sitting alone, reading and eating a sandwich he brought from home. He always sat in the corner of the company cafeteria at the smallest table to discourage company. He was known as a loner, a strange black man who worked in the solitary confinement of the copier room and always had his nose buried in a book. Ray found it hard to relate to his co-workers, even the black ones. Most people lived in their small boxes and had little interest in anything that did not affect them personally. He learned to keep his thoughts to himself, do his job, be cordial to all comers, and then go home to his wife and three kids. Ray was so engrossed in his new literary acquisition, a copy of Walker's Appeal, he didn't notice O'Brien, a payroll clerk from accounting, peering over his shoulder. "You're always reading," said the 40-something red-haired man. Ray slowly closed his book. This white man made reading sound like a crime. Maybe it was for a black man. Ray knew some of his co-workers were puzzled by a black man who didn't chase tail, cheat on his wife, talk a lot of jive, or constantly grin like a damn fool. Ray assumed his strange ways were responsible for his failure to be promoted out of the copier room, despite his bachelor's degree in accounting. After a decade of working for corporate America, Ray had lost his taste for ambition and had settled for earning enough of a living to keep a roof over his family's head and food on the table. Annoyed, Ray glanced at his watch. In 15 minutes, his lunch would be over. He didn't relish wasting it, talking about nothing with a man who didn't speak when they passed in the hallway. "What's that you're reading?" O'Brien asked, eyes reaching across the table. "Walker's Appeal." "Appeal? You studying to be a paralegal?" "Walker's Appeal was written almost 200 years ago by a slave." Ray stopped short. He knew from experience that whites weren't interested in any history but their own, and only the parts that painted them in a flattering light. "I thought slaves couldn't read." O'Brien looked skeptical. "David Walker," Ray repeated firmly, "wrote an appeal condemning slavery. He said slaves should fight for their freedom by any means necessary, and that slaves deserve their share of the wealth they helped create." "You're one of those?" O'Brien folded his arms across his chest. "Those who?" Ray frowned. "You think blacks should get reparations?" "I know we should," said Ray without hesitation. "Why should I pay? My family never owned any slaves." "Blacks didn't put Jews or Japanese in concentration camps, but we paid." "Well, that's different." "How?" "You want reparations? Ask the African chiefs who sold you." "Because slavery didn't make Africa the richest nation on earth." "You think slaves made America rich?" O'Brien's eyes widened in disbelief. "Do you know how much wealth was generated by millions of people working for free for 400 years? Ray asked. "All the work back then had to be done by hand. You didn't have no machines to do it. That's why slaves were so valuable. We never got our 40 acres and a mule. You know how much 40 acres is worth today? Well, what's that got to do with you? Were you a slave? Ray almost said he still was. If he had any doubts, all he had to do was think back a week ago when two white cops pulled him over and frisked him in broad daylight while the other driver slowed down to watch. After no drugs or guns were found, they let him go without one word of apology. Maybe some plantations owners got rich from picking cotton, O'Brien conceded. That didn't make America rich. Ray could not resist the opportunity to educate this ignorant white man. A lot of people, blacks and whites, thought all slaves did was pick cotton, when in reality, slaves were the biggest pool of skilled workers, iron workers, carpenters, planters, inventors, cooks, and baby raisers in the South. Hell, slaves built the damn White House. Say you started a small company that made widgets, Ray continued, ignoring the tight-lipped expression on O'Brien's face. Somehow, it doesn't matter how, you got 10 million people to work for your company for free. They didn't get any salaries, no medical benefits, no pensions, nothing. They worked from sunup to sundown, never took a day off, never took off sick, and they worked until the day they literally dropped dead. Then their kids and their grandkids took their place. I know where, let me finish, Ray said. You got all the credit for the work they did, even the inventions they created to make their work easier, since they were doing all the work anyway. 400 years later, your company's the biggest widget maker in the world. Nobody could compete with you because nobody else had free labor. Your kids, granddaddies, and great-grandkids are super rich because they inherited the company and all the inventions. How in the world could you fix your mouth to say 400 years of free labor didn't make your family rich? The question hung unanswered as the two men stared at each other in silence. You act like we never did nothing for the blacks, O'Brien finally said in a tone ringing with resentment. We who? Ray's laugh was harsh. We did everything for you. What about civil rights, affirmative action, welfare? Who's talking about welfare? A small voice in the back of Ray's head warned him to let it go. He'd noticed the curious looks they were getting as people passed by the table, pretending not to eavesdrop, but he couldn't stop himself. He was sick and tired of eating Jim Crow and choking down white denial. I have never been on welfare a day in my life. I paid taxes the same as you. Didn't nobody give black people civil rights? We died fighting for those rights. The same way me, my daddy, and my granddaddy fought overseas for this country. You ever been in the military? You got all the answers. You tell me. You asked the question, I answered it, Ray said. That's right. He was a smart nigger, the kind of nigger O'Brien's kind had no use for. You people need to get over yourselves. O'Brien's chair scraped the floor as he shoved it back. Nobody's going to pay for something that happened before you were born. It's ridiculous. You people? That's right, you poor black people. We're so sorry we kidnapped you from Africa where you were starving and brought you to America so you can live in the greatest country on earth. And here's the key to the U.S. Treasury. Just take what you think we owe you. Don't worry, we plan to. Ray didn't know how, but he was working on it. You want reparations? O'Brien jammed a hand in his pocket. Start with this. Ray sat as still as a statue as the quarter rolled across the table and bounced off his book. Everything in him wanted to reach out and choke the shit out of that white man for all the David Walkers who had come before him and for all the black men who were still treated like dirt. He opened his book and tried to focus, but the words swam in his blurred vision. O'Brien stood up and leaned on the table, palms flat, eye to eye with Ray. If you hate America so much, O'Brien said quietly, why don't you leave? Because we earned the right to be here, Ray stared into the hard blue eyes without blinking. More than you and anyone else in this room. After O'Brien left, Ray couldn't help wondering if he would be looking for a new job soon. He uncapped the neon yellow highlighter with a trembling hand and swept it across a passage. Let no man of us budge one step, and let slaveholders come to beat us from our country. America is more our country than it is the whites. We have enriched it with our blood and tears. The greatest riches in all America have arisen from our blood and tears. The end of the story. Fact. America would not be the nation it is today without 500 years of free slave labor, economic exploitation, and the cultural, medical, and scientific contributions and ingenuity of Black people. A short list of American corporations that profited from slavery. North American Continent, Aetna Incorporated, American International Group, AIG, Lloyd's of London, New York Life Insurance Company, Fleet Boston Financial Corporation, J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan Bank, Lehman Brothers, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, Lowe's Corporation, Lorillard, Canadian National Railway, CSX Corporation, Norfolk Southern, Union Pacific Railroad. Do Blacks deserve reparations? Hell yes. And we should keep demanding what is due us until we get what is owed us. Recipe number 3, Racial Memories. Chapter 12, Racial Memories. Quote, racial memory touches upon a peculiarity of humankind. We continue to be gravely upset by the frightening events which occurred repeatedly to our numerous ancestors. These racial impressions are a powerful factor in determining the behavior and well-being of large groups of people. End quote. James C. Thompson, 1950. What is a racial memory? According to Carl Jung, a Swiss psychiatrist and founder of analytical psychology, racial memory is a reservoir of the experiences of our species and a form of our collective unconscious. The American Psychological Association, APA, gives another definition for racial memory. The feelings, patterns of thought, and fragments of experience that have been transmitted from generation to generation and all humans that deeply influence the mind and behavior. Is it deja vu or a racial memory? We have all heard a relative say a particular child has the same ways, personality traits, of a deceased family member. Some of us have had a deja vu moment where something that shouldn't be familiar somehow is. We might recall the childhood nightmare that haunted our dreams, or we fear what can't be explained, love who we shouldn't love, or exhibit certain personality traits that have been with us for as long as we can remember. It's possible that some of our personality traits were passed along from our ancestors, from one generation to another. This doesn't mean that we're carbon copies of our ancestors. It just means our mental and emotional characteristics are influenced by the racial memories and experiences of our ancestors. The collective unconscious may contain the experiences, emotions, and memories of our ancestors that are present at birth in the genetic material of every individual. Our DNA-based racial memories may be responsible in part for the Black gender wars between Black males and females. Is talent a form of racial memory? Our collective unconscious may explain the ability some children display at an early age in math, music, art, or science. An example is singer extraordinaire Whitney Houston. Her mother, Sissy Houston, is a Grammy Award-winning gospel singer, and her cousin, Dionne Warwick, is an international music legend. Is their combined musical genius just a lucky family coincidence? Or can the ability to sing be inherited and passed from one generation to the next as a form of racial memory? Are phobias a form of racial memory? Phobias are an irrational, intense, and persistent fear of certain situations, activities, things, or people. Psychologist Martin Seligman conducted experiments on phobias that led him to conclude that certain objects may have a genetic predisposition from birth to being associated with fear. Seligman believed heredity and genetics combined with life experiences played a major role in developing anxiety disorders and phobias. Many behavioral psychologists believe phobias are a throwback to some traumatic event one of our ancestors may have experienced, and that it is possible to inherit those fears and other emotional disorders like depression, schizophrenia, alcoholism, and antisocial personality disorders, the same way we inherit the color of our skin or the shape of our noses. For example, Cynthia, 22, is diagnosed with paganophobia, the fear of men with beards. Cynthia has never had a traumatic experience with a bearded man, but her phobia could suggest she inherited the racial memory of an ancestor who had. Is it possible that her fear of men with beards became a genetic thumbprint memory on her DNA? If one traumatic experience can create a genetic thumbprint, can millions of the same traumatic experiences over a 400-year period create a genetic blueprint that afflicts an entire race? Is fear of the unknown caused by racial memory? Tim, a 43-year-old black male who has never experienced the horrors of slavery, remembers having childhood nightmares of being brutally whipped by a white male. As an adult, he is prone to mood swings, paranoia, and avoids unfamiliar places and people, especially white people. Some call Tim antisocial, but his 87-year-old aunt swears Tim has the same ways as her grandfather Solomon, who was lynched by a white mob in 1919 before Tim was born. Is it possible that Tim inherited his nightmares' racial memories from his great-grandfather's brutal murder? Can racial memories directly affect our behavior? Quote, "It was remarkable to see their physical disposition. They walked into the room with their heads held low, shuffled in for a lack of a better word. They looked like slaves. They had lost their way, and there was no light in their eyes whatsoever," end quote. Dr. Joy DeGruy-Leary, after talking to an audience of black male prisoners at Rikers Island, New York's largest jail. Why do so many young black males view prison as a rite of passage into manhood? Once we examine the physical and spiritual connection between today's prisons and yesterday's slave plantations, the answer is clear. Quote, "My oldest son called me today from prison. He says he wants to transfer to a prison in another state so he can have a private cell and his own TV. He don't care that he's going to be farther from home. He's getting too damn comfortable with his situation. They make prison life so easy for black males. Some of them don't mind being locked up," end quote. George S., 43. Some slaves were afraid to leave the plantation because, as bad as slavery was, the unknown was even more terrifying. They had become so dependent on the slave owner, they didn't believe they could survive on their own in a hostile white world. For similar reasons, young black males are reluctant, terrified of leaving their poor, crime-ridden neighborhoods, plantations, because the unknown may be worse than what is familiar. The psychological war by the supremacy, entertainment, economic, educational system has programmed some black males to believe the only thing they can be successful at is failure. Once they are convinced they are destined to fail, it is easier and safer to waste their lives behind bars. America's prison systems are modern-day plantations for 1 million black males and females trapped in a pre-1865 reality. Can stress trigger racial memories? Some behavioral scientists believe genetic tendencies towards certain mental illnesses can be triggered by environmental stress. Quote, in most cases, an inherited factor needs to be present for schizophrenia to develop. However, without severe environmental stresses, the illness may not appear in those who have a predisposition to it. End quote, Dr. David Rosenthal. If Dr. Rosenthal is correct, could severe environmental stresses like poverty, violence, police abuses, and racism trigger the inherited mental illnesses caused by 400 years of slavery? Racial memories may explain the hostility some whites exhibit toward the descendants of former slaves. Why would the white descendants of victimizers despise the descendants of the victims? Part of the answer may be a psychological condition known as projection, a psychological defense mechanism where a person unconsciously or consciously projects their own undesirable thoughts, feelings, actions, and character flaws onto other people to obtain acquittal by his or her conscience. Extreme guilt is often transformed into resentment, even hatred, because the victimizers cannot stand the reflections in their own mirrors and must project their own bad behavior and character flaws onto their victims. Those flaws are then transformed into the natural character traits of their victims. For example, the wanton and savage slaughter of Native Americans by European invaders was transformed into Indian savages scalping and murdering Europeans. The mass rape of African females was transformed into sexually loose and hot-blooded female slaves, and black male slaves were transformed into black males raping white females. Racial memories, guilt, may be partially responsible for the high rates of drug addictions, mental illnesses, depression, and suicide among the white collective in a futile attempt to self-medicate away or escape the pain of a shameful past and an equally shameful present regarding non-white people. Another possible explanation for the irrational hatred some whites feel toward blacks may be a genetic predisposition, mental illness, to hate, harm non-white people, along with an undeveloped moral conscience and a genetic inability to empathize, feel guilt, shame, or be remorseful towards those who look different. In short, the pathological need to practice racism is a mental, emotional, psychological, and spiritual disorder disease. Racial memories and white supremacy. The racial memories of whites may also explain the white collective's overall disregard for black suffering, police brutality against blacks, discrimination, even the loss of black life, because it was not so long ago that blacks were considered property and less than human. There may be another rarely discussed explanation for the white collective's barely disguised glee toward black suffering. Their own DNA deep racial memories of the days when Africans enslaved their European ancestors.
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for the first audio segment. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Number to dial if you have commentary, questions, thoughts. 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Pamela Evans Harris, co-author, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. A pleasure to be reading her work. Hopefully folks are getting constructive information from what we have read thus far. I posted a report about the burial ground in New York City that was referenced, that was found in the 90s. I tweeted it rather during the broadcast. I'll share it on some other platforms as well. I'll go ahead and nab some of the folks who dialed in with a hand up who have comments or questions for the text. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Copy her.
Yes, sir.
Thomas, how are you doing, Gus?
Right poorly.
Me too. Having a terrible day. My cell phone fell in the toilet of all places, and
Dang.
Now it's not working. So, yeah, I wasn't expecting that today. I have to blame white people, though. Man, I'm glad we're getting out of, history. It was very, certain sections sounded very McGraw-Hillish, it's giving away all our glory, things that we actually did. It's just very hard to listen to. But, Gus, what was the name of that condition that she said makes white people consciously or subconsciously practice racism?
Give me a moment. I will flip back. I was thinking of the racial memory, but I don't think that's it. Give me one second.
Yeah, that was, what she was talking about was right on point there. That was the Acacia records. You could call, look up the Acacia records, and that's where you'll keep a recollection of things that happened to people in your past. It'll just stick with you. Sort of like when they had that tsunami in Sri Lanka and all the dogs ran and the little people stood there like, what's going on? And the water just disappeared and they just went closer out to the water. And the dogs knew to get to the mountains because it's already in their records that, that might have happened to dogs before. And, they knew what to do. The condition, man, that was interesting because I never heard that concept that there's a condition that would make people subconsciously or consciously practice or discriminate against people because they know what their ancestors did. I'm going to have to, if you could give me that name, I want to look that up because, it went against the theory of Dr. Wellsen, which is, I know she uses consciously or subconsciously, but she says it's because of their fear of genetic annihilation because they know they can't mix with anyone. So I just wanted to look that up because that was a whole new spin. The significance of the reading so far, if you caught it, was the creation of the black codes. Very significant because we were not black before that. And You know, they're still on the books. That's what they're using. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. I think she used the term condition, because that's what you keyed on, where she talked about the psychological condition known as projection, and that was in the racial memories section of the book. I'm not sure if that's what you are referencing specifically, but that's where she mentioned.
That's it, Gus.
Oh, okay. Right. Woof. Thought I botched one there. All right. Great. That's on page 84 if you want to get the book or check it out later in your leisure, page 84. Other folks that dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Female caller formerly in New York, now South Carolina, mentioned in the text this week.
Yes. Thank you. All right, so I just had a couple of things that I wanted to bring to people's attention. I thought about Mr. Fuller a lot when reading this particular passage, especially the one that talked about blacks moving north and west, and it brings to mind Mr. Fuller's position on how racism, white supremacy keeps black people on the move all over the planet. And I did make a note stating that racial memory is collective consciousness for black people. I've also heard Mr. Fuller's position on whites being the real niggers, according to what they define as being a nigger, because that came across in Pam's explanation of the term projection. I'm trying to... I don't want to use a metaphor, so I won't. I'm trying to understand and really unpack her surmise that whites have some sort of racial memory, which explains their overall disregard for black suffering. And there may be another rarely discussed explanation for the white collective's barely disguised glee towards black suffering, that their own DNA, deep racial memories of the days when Africans enslaved their European ancestors. For some reason, I'm not sure that... We ought to give white people so much credit, VGQ. I'm believing that they are not capable of having such mental processes, whereas they have some sort of DNA, pineal gland, insight, and memories as we do. I believe that they are just brutal, bare, unabashed, brazen to the core, relentless, disgusting things that do the things that they do. And Thomas talked about dogs known to flee to higher ground. I believe that the dogs are smarter than them. I don't believe that they have all of these mental processes and things and DNA and anything that is involved in the things that they do. I just think that this is just who they are, and it has nothing to do with any kind of memories or processes, whereas being that we are melanated beings and connected to the planet, we are able to ingest and have all of those processes, scientific consciousness and vibratory type of situations and memories that affect us. I'm not believing that they are that well wired. And there was also a mention about, you were talking about the South and how, you know, they have, you know, the Black Wall Street. I recently, there's something going to occur here in a couple of weeks called Jubilee. And one of the highlights of it is a couple of families have, Black families have preserved homes in downtown Columbia, South Carolina, and they were quote unquote free Blacks who were able to have their own businesses. And I'm eager to take a tour of these homes to see exactly how these freed Blacks in the South maintained that lifestyle. And like I said, there were only two families that I'm aware of. And of course, racism, white supremacy pretty much put an end to any of their efforts. And I particularly wanted to look at them to see, I wanted to see pictures of them to see what they looked like, whether or not they could pass for white. And I know one family in particular could not. As a matter of fact, one of them looks like a lot like Viola Davis, the female in the family, the matriarch in the family. But anyway, that's all I had to share thus far. I'm enjoying reading this again. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Give us I guess field notes if you're able to do the outing. Always great to get some local state history about the system and our counter efforts. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings,
may I be
Mr.
heard?
Yes, sir. We heard you as well. We'll get Mr. Demery for first.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
No apologies needed.
Okay. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Greetings, Gus. Mr. Demery for here. I'll start out with, American slavery did not end with the Emancipation Proclamation in 1865. I know that Mr. Scotty Reed is constantly telling us about that. It's even in the Constitution where slavery is allowed. You know, if you are in greater confinement. But she goes on and gives us good points on how this particular institution is still around, and some of the horrific parts of it, like carrying a 20-pound chain around and that chain poisoning. But she also mentioned Parchman's Farm, the chain gang. It's a picture of them. Louisiana in 1911, which reminds me of the book Worse Than Slavery, Parchman's Farm, by David M. Oshinsky. I believe he may have been a guest on the program, but they used this so-called farm, which is actually a prison, to break the will of civil rights workers and freedom riders in the 1960s. Interesting fact was Abraham Lincoln's family owned slaves. I believe his wife, Mary Todd's family, was slave owners. And after Reconstruction, you know, it's interesting. You would pass a bill emancipating or freeing slaves and then give the slave owners the right to, I say, it gave Southern whites all the power to define freedom for the former slaves. Blacks who were promised freedom after fighting in the Civil War for that freedom was denied any say in the process. So then you free them and then give the slave owners the right to interpret it. That's, you know, that's what you would expect from racism, white supremacy. Also, it was interesting the way she broke down the Irish, the poor Irish, and how they became the civil workers, civil city workers, and how the whole thing about Black Wall Street came about. You know, the normal thing, some black man or black boy raping a white girl is any excuse to do, though, to start terrorizing the local niggers. But when it mentioned the law enforcement or lawless enforcement, the military looted and firebombed the black community from the air. And I noticed that I had said, I thought that the Philadelphia was the first air raid terrorism that whites had enacted, but it was much sooner than that. They were terrorizing from the air, you know, way before then. And if I'm not mistaken, those people from CURE, the Caucasians United for Reparations and Emancipation, I believe at least one of them have been on the program. Gus, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Donald Lamb was on the program. And the interesting part of the story of Ray, when he was reading, I guess that was Walker's appeal, and he's talking to his coworker. You know, it's interesting that Ray then would say that he knew some of the coworkers were puzzled by a black man who didn't chase tail, cheat on his wife, or talk a lot of jive, or constantly grin like a damn fool. You know, I guess the anti-blackness has got to come up somewhere in your thinking process. You know, but the white man peeping over his shoulder, and they're always interested when they see a black person reading, because that signifies that you or a thinker, and that you may, in their minds, I guess, get out of line. And another part of that is he could not resist responding to this white man, and he said that he couldn't resist the opportunity to educate the ignorant white man. But it's been my experience that white people are not ignorant about white people. And I don't waste much of my time so-called educating white people about the accomplishments of blacks, because they already know. And I think that her racial memory theory, you know, may be right on. I can't think of anything that would disprove that. So I accept that. And I think that we do deserve reparations. Now I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. We have had some of the folks from CURE on the program. Admitted white supremacist Farrell Winfrey is in that number. Repeat guest, in fact. Caller at 1553. Did you have commentary? Thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes. How you doing, everybody? This is Vic. I'm out of New Jersey. This reading is right on time. I can relate to the exchange between the terrorist white male and the co-worker and black co-worker victim. The exchange that I had didn't go quite that way, but this was a supervisor, and he, for some reason, it was me and another black male in the truck victim, And he goes on to lecture the black community how we, you know, got to get things together, and slavery wasn't all that bad, and, you know, how he's not a racist, and, you know, how we need to clean up our community. So, I mean, at that time, it really didn't surprise me, but being though that this white terrorist was in a position of high authority, in a work hierarchy, you know, I just listened and just took a mental note, you know, so I knew where to place him as I navigated through the workplace. Pam eloquently brought up how black people tend to not want to talk about slavery, how we seem to can't make the correlation to what happened in the past to now, as it relates to my life today. trying to date black females, I try to stay away from these conversations, you know, because it tends to, it tends to not really go well. So maybe I've kind of ended my chances with this particular female, but we got into the conversation, and those were some of her sentiments. Black men need to stop blaming the white man. Black women are doing better than black men. You know, black men need to be held accountable. With the best of my ability, you know, she also was a victim, VGQ. I just gave her some things that she can read. I introduced her to Joy, the group, and the female victim. You know, she texted me, and she said she listened to the Cows episode with Joy DeGruy, and she ordered her book. So I guess I can count that as progress, but I haven't got a call from this particular black female after that exchange. That's all I have right now.
Much obliged, Dr. Joy DeGruy, three-time guest on the Cows. Gusty met her personally in the great state of Wisconsin at the White Privilege Conference way back when. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
Yes, can I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Scotty Reed, founder of Black Talk Radio Network.
Greetings, Gus, and to all the listeners. I'm going to try to be quick and concise because I know time is limited. I appreciate Mr. Demery for acknowledging that slavery has not been abolished. It's in the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. On the notes I was taking as I was listening, glad that you are doing this book. Wish that I had known that it had material on slavery when Pam was still with us in this plane of existence. But Frederick Douglass, after the passage of the issuance, not passage, but issuance, because it was an executive order by Lincoln of the Emancipation Proclamation, Frederick Douglass called it a stupendous fraud, which is one of his famous speeches. Also, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free any victims of slavery who were in states not in rebellion. That's in that emancipation. So, for example, Kentucky, which did not join the Confederacy but had victims of slavery, were allowed to continue to practice slavery because they weren't in rebellion to the federal government. Then the 13th Amendment was passed in 1965, which says that slavery and involuntary servitude shall be abolished except as punishment for crime, which led to some of the stuff she touched upon, the chain gangs, which are still around. I see them in my little rural area out there picking up trash and working on the road, filling potholes and stuff. With armed guards, with shotguns and things of that nature. So that led to what was called the convict leasing. Now we're in the era of private prisons and what they call mass incarceration, which I think is a metaphor for slavery. I call it what the Constitution calls it. It calls it slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for quote unquote crime. The part about her saying whites are conditioned to be the way they are, I think there's some truth to that. I had the opportunity to hear a audio clip of a documentary on New Abolitionist Radio Wednesday night that said that following the Civil War, the so-called Daughters of the Confederacy that are largely responsible for all of these monuments to the Confederacy that we still see today, they also were writing the school curriculum, and they totally rewrote history to make themselves out to be victims, to make it seem like slavery wasn't so bad. They talked about in the textbook seeing how the slave master would have a picnic for his victims and things. So that was taught in their curriculum, and this was standard education curriculum up until the 1950s. And I still say they still programming them with this disinformation and rewriting history. Media propaganda, very powerful, controls the minds of the masses, as Malcolm X said. They'll even get victims to pay to tell you today that racism don't exist. The book mentioned Angola prison, and she said, you know, how I forgot the date she mentioned, but, you know, during this lifetime, you know, they was down there picking cotton and what have you, and doing other agriculture. That's across the United States. Not only are they picking cotton still and fruits and vegetables, they have my little brother who I talked to today, trying to get him an interview with France 24, who's looking to interview a victim of prison slavery, considering we're in this prison strike right now against slavery. But he was telling me he was working on a turkey farm, processing turkey, doing other dangerous jobs and what have you for slave wages, pennies on the dollar. Also, when she mentioned Angola, she talked about how it was named after the African nation where these victims came from. Okay. So the last thing that I'll say about that is the last week's segment, the question that I don't think anybody answered, where are the slave ships? And if you just do a quick Google search, slave ship museums in America, there are several of them in several different states, Washington, D.C. as well. Do they have these ships? No, they don't. They also don't have the ships anymore that brought the first European settlers over here. They do have recreated those ships. That's because wood deteriorates. It is an organic material, and especially if it gets wet, it will disintegrate over time. This was wood. If a ship became unseaworthy, they would be broken down and made into these cabins that these colonists were living in. We don't have a bunch of those cabins around anymore because, again, wood does not last forever. But there are a number of museums and wreckage that has been found off the coast of North Carolina, off the coast of Africa. The recent one I'm aware of is in Louisiana, where they tried to – this was after slavery was so-called abolished – and the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed by the British first. They found a ship. They tried to sneak in. Well, they did. They snuck in some Africans, and Zora Neale Hurston actually interviewed the last person. Black writers are very important, but she interviewed the last person who was on that last ship. And they found the wreckage of it in, I think it was the Mississippi River. They tried to burn it to hide what they had done, but some of the remains was found in the sediment, and that was in Louisiana. But thank you for choosing this book. I'm really missing Pam now. Will love to conversate with her on this, but, you know, again, writing is very important, just like reading is more important than watching television, as I often hear on this program. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Reed. Other folks that we've missed completely, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings, beautiful people. I wanted to take a moment just to kind of flesh out a little bit of the genetics parts that she was talking about, in part because I'm just fascinated by genetics and studying it, but also that way maybe it might spark interest in other people to do more research into how the genetics actually work. So if it's the question, if the question is it possible to transfer emotional traits onto your offspring, the overwhelming body of evidence suggests that it is possible. And how it works is as everything that occurs to an individual organism, to say a human being, that the human being experiences, witnesses, causes reactions within the body at a cellular level. So you have your cells that make up your tissues, that make up your organs, that make up organ systems, that make up the organism. So within the cell, like every cell of your body, the billions of cells in your body, all have DNA that code for proteins, which are functional units of life, that proteins will become the hormones that get flooded into the system, say like cortisol or epinephrine or norepinephrine, that will bind to other parts of your cells to make you feel a certain type of way. So the most common physiological response that most people are familiar with is the fear and the, flight and fight response of the body. So if you are frightened, you know, your systems react in such a way to make it so that you're ready to fight something or you're ready to run away. And so even if we were to only consider just that pathway, just that one experience of the body having physiological responses to being frightened all the time, all of that is sending chemicals into the body to prepare you to do those things. So to make your heart beat faster, to make your eyes dilate, to make your lungs breathe better, to give you that shot of adrenaline, to make you, you know, like that, more alert, more, what alertness would look like continuously could be anxiety. So, you know, a constant type of, like, on pointness, I guess, is maybe not the most scientific way to put it, but for my purposes, it works. And so if you have that constantly, your body is going to try to establish a homeostasis with that, a regulation point to say, okay, well, this is just a really dangerous environment, and I need to make sure that I'm always ready for it. So as the man is producing his sperm and the woman is producing her eggs, these things are being encoded into the DNA of the offspring that they will both produce when they mate. So two individuals highly stressed with all that going on does affect, like, it lets the DNA know, okay, this is a hostile environment, this is the new system that we have, this is what we're going to give to the offspring. So that's one level of it. But then if the offspring, now the egg is fertilized inside of the woman, she's stressed, she's raped, all of that, like, at a chemical level, meaning that it's a fact. It's not, you know, just something like I can't touch. It's like if I could draw blood, you could measure the amount of hormones and chemicals flooding your body, which is changing your brain chemistry, which is changing, you know, everything about you at every moment, everything you experience. The child learns about the world before the baby is born through the experiences of the mother. So if the mother is stressed, then yes. The point that I'm getting at is it possible to have racial memory? Absolutely, scientifically, without a doubt, it's impossible not to. That's evolution. Like, that's how this thing keeps going on. I also was extremely, you know, geeking over here when she mentioned schizophrenia. I've been participating on a research team studying genetic precursors for schizophrenia, and that's a recessive trait, meaning, like, you know, you need two people who carry the recessive trait in order for it to happen. That usually happens in incest. So schizophrenia at a, like, physiological, biological level, like not just looking at the psychosis part, does happen in higher proportions of people who are classified as white. However, because psychiatric or mental diagnoses are kind of subjective, like you're just looking at the behavior patterns, or, you know, maladaptive behavior patterns of people, they could be misdiagnosed. So you can have bipolar, you can have schizophrenia, and you can have, like, a MAPLAR, like a mixture of them. And they, you know, have different, like, once you start having auditory and visual hallucinations, then you would be considered schizophrenic if you're having solar, or, like, having only solely, you know, auditory ones, then you would be bipolar, and then you can have breaks before you become a full-on schizophrenic and all that kind of stuff. But if we're talking about the non-white people and what it, us being classified as schizophrenic, not the recessive genetic type of it, but like having psychosis and stuff like that, then it is really, really possible that these a bunch of factors on the outside could make us express those things through in further generations because they would encode on the DNA. And it's just like a fact thing that we definitely deserve justice. And I'll just leave it there.
Much obliged, Emmy. Radiant as usual. Other folks we've missed completely.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I definitely appreciate, if nothing else, like the little like fictional stories within the text that kind of lay the groundwork for what the chapter is going to be speaking about. And when the authors spoke about the different Black codes, and I appreciated the Black codes that were spoken about in the northern states. And I know not that long ago, I had looked up basically the Black codes of Ohio, because of course that was not something that was even mentioned when I was going to school, and even like, of course, in like the white schools, we were supposed to have more information. So I can definitely appreciate that, because the main thing that they, you know, kind of spoke about was how, I guess in today's terms, more liberal the North was compared to the South. The other thing, I've never heard of Cure. I'm definitely going to have to go back in the archives and listen to some of the, I guess Cure members. Definitely, I think that's a great illustration of white women, you know, practicing racism. And actually, I don't know if this is like a side note or not, but all of this, that I definitely am learning a lot from the book, but it kind of, you know, keeps making me think about, you know, how white women say that, you know, they are most oppressed, and then you have the gays and, you know, anti-sexuals, whatever. But just even like some of the things brought up in this book, it's like, women didn't, you know, they didn't form their own groups and were racially terrorized by a, you know, a white man group, because that's supposed to be the only ones who are practicing racism. Like, you know, of course, understood like the Ku Klux Klan, hearing stories about them. But, you know, even like with the anti-sexuals not being, you know, with, you know, having 50 different cities just mainly filled with anti-sexuals and even immigrants, you know, with these sanctuary cities. Not being, you know, terrorized and then moved somewhere else. So I definitely appreciate that. And even the when it was mentioned, like just the relationship between Irish and the quote unquote Irish and the you know, the victims of slavery and their descendants, and how they had Irish last names. So I thought that was definitely appreciated that fact. And I know I definitely agree with a lot of what Mr. Demery Ford said as well. And I guess I'll, the last thing is with the story about, I think it was Ray, and the white man. I remember in my past kind of having maybe a little bit of not being so aggressive, but with some of that, I guess I wouldn't call it aggressive, but vocal, you know, exchange between white, mainly my exchange between white women, and just seeing how, you know, it's constantly a, you know, well, I didn't do this to you and you weren't affected by this. But even the part in here where it said, you know, we have to pay reparations to basically Jewish people and Japanese people, and looking up and actually hearing it from a different show about how even today, all Black taxpayers, all taxpayers, we have to pay reparations to quote-unquote Jewish and the quote-unquote Jewish state. So definitely made me reflect on that. And I'll meet my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Other folks we've missed completely.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is Henry from Chicago. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. The story on Ray is very, I mean, it's basically my experience when I'm in white corporate America. If you basically want white people to bother you when you don't want to be bothered, have a book and read it and just have, you know, just have it out. Rest assured, a white person will come up and ask you what you're reading. It never fails. That's why when I had bought a Kindle, it was a lot easier. And then I started putting earbuds, in my ears, so white people can leave me alone while I'm reading. But in the story, you know, I guess from my experience, I think Ray should have just basically deaded the issue in regards to what he was reading, because, you know, as far as white people, they don't want to deal in truth. So, you know, even though Ray is telling them everything that, you know, that is truthful, O'Brien, the white person, doesn't care. Just like with white people, they don't care. You know, as long as they're running in the system of white supremacy, it doesn't matter, you know, what the truth is. In regards to the racial memory, there was one paragraph that I was kind of, having trouble with in regards to, and the paragraph states, the racial memory's guilt may be partially responsible for the high rates of drug addiction, mental illness, depression, and suicide among the white collective in a futile attempt to self-medicate away or escape the pain of a shameful past and an equally shameful present regarding non-white people. From my opinion, I don't think white people are shameful for what they've done. And I just think that, you know, the drug addiction, mental illness, and depression among them is just, you know, a degeneracy amongst them. So I don't think it's shame. I just think they're just degenerate, you know. So that's all I have right now in my mind.
Much obliged. I do not think whites are guilty about the practice of white terrorism either. We have time for one more caller before we get to the second audio segment. Who wants to share?
Before? Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, everyone. As far as what I observe about the pattern of the book, I can see Miss Evans the Great being somewhat like an attorney who is making her case, and I would say quite eloquently. She's making her case, and she's compiling evidence based on the present condition of black males and black females. And she is very scientific in her approach through the book, in her way, VGQ. The segment about the Irish, I thought was pretty interesting. It's not new to me, you know, as far as with those names, Smith and Jones, you know, Edwards, so somewhat. I hear some background.
I think we got it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah. And also as far as under the people activity of employment, and the shrewd way that the racist white supremacists were able to indoctrinate and or convince this group of white people that are called Irish into the system of racism white supremacy. And she is accurate in a lot of her analysis specifically about employment with the fire department, police department, and other quote-unquote civil servant jobs. Book incident at work that she described, I had many of them on the fire department. One specifically in particular, I had a small, I wouldn't even call it a book, it was like a pamphlet. It was so small. And it's important in the story because, you know, I mean, it's a very small, book. And had a call, put the book up, in the bathroom on top of the napkin, thing in the bathroom, and went on the call, came back looking for my book, wondering where it's at. It's in the hands of the battalion chief. Apparently, one of my white coworkers was looking at me the whole time of reading this book. The book was on Malcolm X and some of his speeches, something like that. And in turn, he called me in his office about the book. And basically, I was stating my right to read any type of material that I want to read. And and similar to the story with the former teammate of Jim Brown, I had a similar moment. I just go on from there. The period of time that she was speaking about, specifically in this part of the world, as far as the origins, scientific history of race and white supremacy in this part of the world that is identified as the Northwestern Hemisphere. I call it the time when the system of race and white supremacy was in its expansion period. It was expanding, and she's giving a good description of what was going on at the time, as far as quote unquote slavery is concerned. Scientific sense, that more known sense of slavery, and what was going on at a particular time and how it was going down. I think she has some good points. The case with the ships,
30
and
seconds.
I've heard it quite a bit over time with the ships. I just have an idea that maybe the white supremacists don't want to help the victims of racism as far as evidence towards their misdeeds, on why they don't want to come up with some of this evidence about ships and whatnot. But every ship had a manifest about who was on the ship and whatnot, and that might be something to do some research on. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think there might have been two other callers that we did not get, but you all will be first up after the second audio segment concludes. I'm very appreciative that so many people wanted to share a thought and participate in reading Pamela Evans Harris's second publication, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We will go ahead with the second audio segment. We are picking up recipe number 4. Slave traditions. It should be page 87. That's where we should be starting at. Context of white supremacy. Audio segment number 2.
Why whites loved the movie Precious and blacks hated it. Quote, do you know how many thousands of years whites were dominated by Africans or people of African descent? I think they, whites, get some kind of abject pleasure from these pleading, lamentable scenarios of their Negroes of the sort of, ha ha, look at you now. Do you realize the wealth that was seen as an African birthright in those days? Europeans, on average, did not even eat fruit or taste the sweetness of sugar, and their meats were salted or sour. Their growth was stunted on average, and nutritional disorders were rampant. Infant mortality was through the roof. These conditions existed to the late 1500s. And the Africans were tall and strong, and they wore woven fabrics colorful with rich textures. Their meats were sweet, and fruit was plentiful. And the African gold, there was no other metal so beautiful. This is not some kind of black fantasy I'm talking about. This account is real, and no one will contest the veracity thereof. I guess for these reasons, our pain is so sweet. End quote. D.B., historian. The Slave's Dream by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, 1807-1882. Beside the ungathered rice he lay, his sickle in his hand. His breast was bare, his matted hair was buried in the sand. Again, in the midst and shadow of sleep, he saw his native land. Wide through the landscape of his dreams, the lordly Niger flowed. Beneath the palm trees on the plain, once more a king he strode, and heard the tinkling caravans descend the mountain road. He saw once more his dark-eyed queen among her children stand. They clasped his neck, they kissed his cheeks, they held him by the hand. A tear burst from the sleeper's lids and fell into the sand. And then at furious speed he rode along the Niger's bank. His bridle reins were golden chains, and with a metal clank, at each leap he could feel the scabbard of steel smiting his stallion's flank. Before him, like a blood-red flag, the bright flamingos flew. From morn till night he followed their flight o'er plains where the tamarind grew, till he saw the roofs of Kaffir huts and the ocean rose to view. At night he heard the lion roar and the hyena scream, and the river horse as he crushed the reeds beside some hidden stream, and it passed like a glorious roll of drums through the triumph of his dream. The forests with their myriad tongues shouted of liberty, and the blast of the desert cried aloud with a voice so wild and free that he started in his sleep and smiled at their tempestuous glee. He did not feel the driver's whip nor the burning heat of day, for death had illumined the land of sleep, and his lifeless body lay a worn-out fetter that the soul had broken and thrown away. Recipe number 4, Slave Traditions. Chapter 13, Slave Traditions. What are slave traditions? A tradition is a set of behaviors and beliefs that are passed from one generation to the next. Traditions provide the tools to civilize or uncivilize a group of people and establish order or disorder. The best traditions promote prosperity, economic survival, and build strong families, genetic survival. All human societies, whether primitive or advanced, are bound by traditions. All human beings, if given free choice, will establish the kind of traditions that benefit their group. However, when a group's natural traditions are destroyed and new traditions are created by their enemies, the predictable end result is disorder and chaos. After African slaves were forced to abandon their original civilizing traditions, they had to adapt to the unnatural, barbaric traditions of the slave owners that were designed to keep them enslaved. The ugly words blacks used against blacks are slave traditions. It is unheard of for a white person to insult another white person by saying, "with your white ugly self," or for a Japanese person to say to another Japanese person, "with your Japanese ugly self." But it is very common to hear a black person say, "with your black ugly self," to another black person. For some blacks, the words Black and ugly go together like snow and white, even to the extent that one of the most popular black shows in television history, Sanford and Son, was built around blacks degrading the physical features and intelligence of other blacks. Why? It's a slave tradition. Blacks mistreating other blacks is a slave tradition. When slaves were tortured and killed for trying to protect each other, it is easy to understand why some blacks still feel it is unnatural to trust, protect, or cooperate with other blacks. It's a slave tradition. When black authority on the plantation represented slaves brutalizing other slaves, doing the slave owner's dirty work, it is easy to understand why so many blacks still distrust black authority and are still fearful of white authority. It's a slave tradition. When slaves were forced to witness the suffering of their loved ones and were helpless to stop it, which is still happening to blacks in the 21st century, it is easy to understand why some blacks today have become numb towards the suffering of other blacks. It's a slave tradition. Blacks fearing whites is a slave tradition. After 500 years of brutality against slaves and freed blacks in a white society where even the most impoverished white civil servant, a police or security guard, can take a black life, commit murder, without suffering any consequences, it is easy to understand why blacks still fear white authority. It's a slave tradition. Blacks appeasing and pleasing whites is a slave tradition. When slaves were forced by white slave owners to call other slaves niggers, it's easy to understand why so many blacks today feel it is natural to degrade other blacks in the presence of whites. It's a slave tradition. When slaves were forced to speak in broken English and were forbidden to read or write to reassure whites they would remain intellectually inferior, it's easy to understand why blacks collectively are behind in the 500-year educational game compared to whites. It's a slave tradition. Black dependency and poverty is a slave tradition. According to a 2010 study by Brandeis University in Massachusetts, the typical white family is 5 times richer than its black counterpart of the same class. The typical assets of black families averaged just $5,000 compared to white families who averaged $100,000. In nearly every black community in the nation, blacks own a tiny minority of the businesses there. We are not only totally dependent on whites for all our necessities, food, transportation, clothing, shelter, utilities, fire and police protection, we are just as dependent on the non-white immigrants who have literally just stepped off the boat. The majority of blacks in America are consumers, not producers, and the vast majority of that majority see nothing wrong with that picture. In spite of the hard, cold evidence of Hurricane Katrina just 5 short years ago, too many blacks still believe white America will feed, house, and clothe its black population even in the event of an economic collapse. Why do we cling to this obviously false belief? It's a slave tradition. Soul food is a slave tradition. Quote, what you gonna do when the meat give out? What you gonna do when the meat give out? Set in the corner with my lips pushed out? Lousy, end quote. Lucinda Davis, former slave. Slaves had 2 choices, to eat the parts of animals and plants that whites considered unfit for human consumption, or starve. They used their creativity and plenty of seasoning to create what is known today as soul food. Due to its scarcity, food became a source of comfort for slaves. When food is scarce, it becomes a status symbol and a source of security for those deprived of a plentiful supply. It is not surprising every occasion or celebration in the Black community centers around excessive food consumption. Why? It's a slave tradition. Avoiding emotional intimacy is a slave tradition. When the parents of slave children were unable to protect their children from predatory slave owners, it is easy to understand why so many Black parents today still feel they cannot protect their children from street or law enforcement predators. It's a slave tradition. When Black males and females were forbidden to love each other and lived with the daily terror that their loved ones could be sold to another plantation and never seen again, it is easy to understand why some Blacks are still afraid of loving each other too much and why it's so easy to love someone white because we have no real emotional or spiritual attachment to them. It's a slave tradition. Beating and whipping our Black children is a slave tradition. Black mothers and fathers beating and cursing their children in public is a common sight in many Black communities. Slave mothers used to beat and curse their children in front of the slave owner to prove their children needed no further punishment. Why do so many Black parents today still feel it is in their children's best interest to abuse them? It's a slave tradition. Black males not supporting, protecting, or giving their children their last name is a slave tradition. Black male slaves were not allowed to father or claim their children. Why do some Black males today voluntarily abandon their children, refuse to sign birth certificates, and breed children with multiple females they cannot support financially or emotionally? It's a slave tradition. Blacks breeding with whites to whiten their offspring is a slave owner's tradition. When lighter-skinned slaves were treated better than dark-skinned slaves, it is understandable why some Blacks favor lighter-skinned children. It's a slave owner's tradition. Believing the topic of slavery should be gone and forgotten is a slave owner's tradition. Blacks who claim slavery has nothing to do with the present condition of Black people today are practicing the same slave traditions of those who claim Blacks are inferior due to genetics, not because of 500 years of racist oppression. Why? It's a slave tradition. Blacks celebrating national holidays that promote white supremacy is a slave owner's tradition. Holidays celebrate the heroes and traditions of a people. Almost every American holiday, with the exception of Dr. King's birthday, is founded on the promotion and justification of white supremacy. Five examples. Christopher Columbus Day credits European invaders for discovering a country that was already occupied by the original indigenous non-white population, what is known today as Native Americans. George Washington's birthday celebrates the birth of the first U.S. president who owned African human beings. Abraham Lincoln's birthday celebrates the 16th president as an emancipator of Black slaves, when in reality, he believed Blacks were inferior and should be treated as such. His family also owned slaves. Thanksgiving, a time to give thanks, was, in reality, a celebration of the bloody slaughter, genocide, of Native Americans by Europeans. Christmas, marketed as a pseudo-religious holiday, when in fact it is based on the myth that Jesus was born on December 25th and is more about excessive materialism, courtesy of a white Santa Claus. Most American holidays celebrate the enslavement, abuse, exploitation, and murder of non-white people. Why? It's a white supremacy tradition. Quote, "So you call for the same God he calls for when he's putting a rope around your neck. You call for God and he calls for God. And you wonder why the one you call on never answers you." End quote. Malcolm X, 1925 through 1965. Blacks who practiced the same religion slave owners taught slaves during slavery are practicing a slave tradition. Slave owners used Christianity and the image of a white God and a white blue-eyed Jesus to brainwash slaves to believe they would displease God, aka the white man, if they ran away or rebelled against their enslavement. A slave owner, in a speech given to a slave, said, quote, "You are rebellious sinners. Your hearts are filled with all manners of evil. 'Tis the devil who tempts you. God is angry with you and will surely punish you if you don't forsake your wicked ways. Instead of serving your masters faithfully, which is pleasing in the sight of your heavenly master, you are idle and shirk your work. God sees you. You tell lies. God hears you. Instead of engaging in worshiping him, you are hidden away somewhere feasting on your master's substance, tossing coffee grounds with some wicked fortune teller, or cutting cards with another old hag. Your master may not find out, but God sees you, and he will punish you." End quote. Source: Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Murdering blacks is an American slave tradition. In the book Without Sanctuary, author James Allen presents an extraordinary and revealing collection of photographs and postcards that were kept as souvenirs at the lynchings of black men, women, and children as young as 10 years old by murderous white mobs. Quote, "Nationally, homicide is the leading cause of death for black young men ages 10 to 24 and the second leading cause of death for black women ages 15 through 24. End quote. Black on Black Crime Coalition. Roll call, a very short list of murder by cop victims. The long list of unarmed black males and females includes LaTanya Haggerty, Donta Dawson, Michael Bayoun, Moses De Jesus, Robert Russ, Joseph Gould, Taisha Miller, Amadou Diallo, Catherine Johnston, Sean Bell, and Oscar Grant. This very short, very incomplete list of potentially tens of thousands of black victims leads to an important question. Why do so many blacks, especially young black males, believe their lives and the lives of other black people have so little value? Because murdering blacks is an American tradition. It is well past time for the descendants of slaves to abandon the slave traditions that celebrate the slaughter and enslavement of our ancestors and other non-white people and recreate the kind of historically and morally correct traditions that reflect knowledge of and respect for self. Strange fruit. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia sweet and fresh, and the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for a tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop. By Lewis Allen, 1939. Recipe number 5, The Secret Shame of Slavery. Chapter 14, The Secret Shame of Slavery. Quote, "To accept one's past, one's history, is not the same thing as drowning in it. It is learning how to use it. An invented past can never be used. It cracks and crumbles under the pressures of life like clay in a season of drought." End quote. James Baldwin, 1924-1987. The Hollywood myth of the childlike, happy slave. Why did Hollywood films during the early to mid-1900s portray blacks as savage, stupid, cowardly, lazy, and less than human beings? To justify the lie that blacks were not intelligent or deserving enough to be free from slavery and racist oppression. Quote, "I was raised in Chicago, but spent my summers with relatives in Mississippi. One of my uncles would drive up to Chicago and pick me and my brothers and sisters up in a big white Cadillac. My mama always fixed us a big shopping bag of fried chicken, potato salad and chips, and an ice cooler filled with pop for the road. I was too young and ignorant to know why we had to take enough food for a whole day or why we had to pee in the bushes by the road. I didn't know blacks couldn't eat in restaurants or use public bathrooms in the South. When my uncle took us to the movies, we sat in the balcony and the whites sat downstairs. But I was afraid to ask why, like I knew it would embarrass my uncle. We didn't talk about those things in those days, or maybe the adults talked about it when we wasn't around. Maybe they was too ashamed to let us kids know how bad the whites treated them and how much shit they took off them. I think this has to do a lot with why blacks avoid our history. Nobody wants to admit their people were slaves and didn't or couldn't do anything about it. Maybe we were afraid we let white people make fools of us because we really were inferior." End quote. Samuel, 63, postal worker. For Samuel's sake, and for all the countless black children and adults who grew up being ashamed of our tragic past, we'd like to set the record straight. Fact number 1, slaves were not docile, happy, or submissive. Some slaves submitted to the daily brutality of slavery, but there were many others who refused to bend or break under the lash of the overseer's whip. Some slaves poisoned their slave owners with arsenic and ground up glass. Some attacked slave owners with axes, knives, and anything that could be used as a weapon. Some burned down homes and destroyed livestock and crops. Slaves Resist, excerpt from the Black Chronicle article published in 1831. Slaves are not happy, docile servants. In the manner of livestock, they are usually worked unmercifully, then kept in huts or shackles until their service is required again. But despite their suffering and deprivation, these human beings resist and resist daily. Black Chronicle is fortunate to have spoken with several escaped slaves. They expressed deep resentment for their masters, the men who reaped the benefits of their work. To resist, we were told slaves will do almost anything. Planters report losing over half their tobacco crops because their slaves slow down during the best picking season. When worked beyond endurance, slaves often flee to the swamps, returning when their demands for better conditions are met. Occasionally, they simply refuse to work. "In working niggers," one plantation owner has said, "we always calculate that they will never labor at all except to avoid punishment, and they will never do more than just enough to save themselves for being punished." We were told that black overseers do not even attempt to stop slaves from destroying their master's property. They let cattle wander in fields of ripe crops, leave gates open so animals can escape, and destroy tools as rapidly as they are replaced. Slaves sometimes injure themselves rather than obey the man who calls himself their owner. In the greatest act of resistance, some slaves commit suicide and others kill members of their family. I had 13 children, boasted one black woman. Every one I destroyed with my own hands rather than have them suffer slavery. Slaveholders know that such frustration could lead to their destruction. The least unusual noise at night alarms them greatly, said one slave. They cry out, "What is that? Are the boys all in?" Fact number two, slave owners lived in constant fear of their slaves. Slave owners in the South lived in constant fear of runaway slaves, property, crop damage, sabotage, slave rebellions, and of being attacked or murdered in their sleep. Some slaves refused to bow, smile, be subservient, or submissive. Others resorted to work slowdowns, committed suicide, and thousands ran away each year. Quote, "They did this so often that it is nothing short of amazing that the myth of the docile Negro persists," end quote, writes Lerone Bennett Jr. in Before the Mayflower, A History of the Negro in America, 1619 through 1964. They poisoned masters and mistresses with arsenic, ground glass, and spiders beaten up in buttermilk. They chopped them, slaveholders, to pieces with axes and burned their houses, gins, and barns to the ground. Contrary to the racist Hollywood myth of the happy-go-lucky slave who was content with his or her circumstances, thousands of slaves resisted and fought back their enslavement. Historian Herbert Aptheker calculated over 200 separate slave revolts took place between the 1600s to 1865. That comes to approximately one revolt per year, proof that slaves violently resisted their enslavement. Nat Turner's Slave Rebellion, 1831, an actual recount by the Anglo-African magazine, December 1859, New York. Nat Turner attacked Virginia from within with six men and with the determination to spare no life until his power was established. We must pass over the details of horror as they occurred during the next 24 hours. Swift and stealthily, as Indians, the black men passed from house to house, not pausing, not hesitating, as their terrible work went on. In one thing, they were humaner than Indians, or than white men fighting against Indians. There was no gratuitous outrage beyond the death blow itself. No insult, no mutilation, but in every house they entered, that blow fell on man, woman, and child. Nothing that had a white skin was spared. From every house they took arms and ammunition, and from a few, money. On every plantation they found recruits, those dusky slaves, so obsequious to their master the day before, so prompt to sing and dance before his northern visitors, were all swift to transform themselves into fiends of retribution now. Show them sword or musket, and they grasped it, though it were an heirloom from Washington himself. The troop increased from house to house, first to 15, then to 40, then to 60. Some were armed with muskets, some with axes, some with scythes. Some came on their master's horses. As the numbers increased, they could be divided, and the awful work was carried on more rapidly still. The plan then was for an advance guard of horsemen to approach each house at a gallop and surround it till the others came up. The outbreak lasted for but 48 hours, but during that period, 55 whites were slain without the loss of a single slave. These Negroes had been systematically brutalized from childhood. They had been allowed no legalized or permanent marriage. They had beheld around them an habitual licentiousness such as can scarcely exist except under slavery. Some of them had seen their wives and sisters habitually polluted by the husbands and brothers of these fair white women who were now absolutely in their power. Yet I have looked through the Virginia newspapers of that time in vain for one charge of an indecent outrage on a woman against these triumphant and terrible slaves. Wherever they went, there went death, and that was all. Mrs. Stowe's picture of Dred's purpose is then precisely typical of his. Whom the Lord saith unto us, smite, them we will smite. We will not torment them with the scourge and fire, nor defile their women as they have done with ours, but we will slay them utterly and consume them off the face of the earth. True stories Hollywood would never tell. A very short list of slave rebellions. 1663, first major slave revolt. 1712, New York slave revolt, 9 whites killed. 1730, Norfolk, Virginia slave revolt. 1733, St. John slave revolt. 1739, Stono Rebellion in South Carolina, 25 whites killed. 1741, New York City slave revolt. 1760, Tacky's War, Jamaica. 1773, slaves in Massachusetts petitioned legislature for freedom. 1791, slave revolts in Haiti led to the Haitian Revolution. 1800, Prosser slave revolt led by Gabriel Prosser and 1,000 slaves. 1805, Chatham Manor, Virginia. 1811, Louisiana slave revolt was the largest slave revolt in U.S. history. 1815, George Boxley, Virginia. 1816, 300 slaves took over Fort Blount until U.S. troops attacked. 1822, Denmark Vesey slave revolt involved thousands of slaves. 1829, slave revolt in Cincinnati, Ohio. 1831, Nat Turner slave revolt, over 60 whites killed. An insurrection has broken out in Southampton. By the last accounts, there were 60 whites killed, and the militia was retreating. It was reported that 300 militia were retreating before 600 to 800 rebels, Southampton, Virginia. 1835, Black Seminole Slave Rebellion. 1839, Amistad Slave Revolt Mutiny. 1841, slaves overpowered crew on slave ship Creole and sailed to the Bahamas, where they were granted asylum, freedom. 1842, slave revolt in the Cherokee Nation. 1849, Harriet Tubman's escape from slavery. She returned to South 19 more times and freed 300 slaves. 1857, escaped slaves fight pursuers. 12 fleeing slave fugitives surprised their 10 pursuers by turning on them and waging a furious battle. When the slave hunters retreated to plan another attack, the slaves ran into the forest. This is the third confrontation in Chester, Pennsylvania, in recent months, March 5, 1857. 1859, John Brown, along with 5 slaves and 13 whites, led a slave revolt. Fact number 3, over 1 million European Christians were enslaved by North African black Muslims between 1830 and 1780, according to a new study by Robert Davis, a professor of history at Ohio State University. Apparently, Black people aren't the only people stamped with the shame of slavery.
And that will wrap us for this week's session of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We will pick up next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be on Recipe 6, the Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome. Looking forward to it. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, I will nab. I think we had at least two people who did not get a chance to share when we wrapped up the first audio segment. Ivy and the caller at 2262. If either of you had commentary, line should be open, and then we will nab everyone else. Did you two have commentary you wanted to get in?
May I be here?
Yes, ma'am.
Did I interrupt you, Gus, when you were talking?
Nope, all done.
Okay. Greetings to you and greetings to all the callers on the line. Just wanted to pull up my notes, but I got them. Thank you so much for this beautiful tribute. Just last week when you were giving up your time to play clips of her, this is just incredible, this tribute that you've given. I think it really needs to be pointed out that the codified software developer said that white people are going to be white. That is a hashtag, a sound clip, a T-shirt, a wristband. Just an incredible quote. As far as, like, this book is incredible, and I want to say that, you know, people mistreat each other, just period. That happened, you know, before white people, and they murdered each other. And, you know, different groups, that happens, they get into conflict. But whites murder Black people far more than Black people murder Black people. Just, there are hundreds of thousands of us who are homeless. And, you know, the average time for a homeless person to live is 50. So you might as well just go and shoot 50-year-olds. It's pretty much, you know, what they're doing. Millions of us in poverty, vulnerable to just death because of these savages. As far as the leading cause of death, that can be said for, you know, white people as well in terms of, you know, those particular ages. So it's nothing really special about that. It's not true. It's not statistically insignificant in terms of Black men with multiple mothers. Black people don't even have children. We have like less than 650,000 children a year. White people have like 2 and 3 million. So that's just not, you know, it's just not, Black men shouldn't just really be called out for that. It's just not statistically significant in terms of the perpetrators of that, as far as Black men are concerned. As far as, you know, just how, you know, I think that a lot of the things that was listed in terms of, you know, mistreating each other and our bad education and things of that nature, that to me is not a result of slave traditions at all. That's a result to me of things that are going on right now, that there are bad schools right now. There's economic terrorism right now. I don't think Black people necessarily think white people will feed them. I think we just hope they will. It's not statistically significant in terms of, you know, Black men not having their children's last name and refusing to do that. And also you can't just put that on them, because women are, you know, largely responsible for just, you know, mistreating men, in terms of, you know, denying them those things. I've seen this happen. As far as this abandoning thing as well, that's not statistically significant either. And on top of that, just because you don't live in the same house, that doesn't mean that you've abandoned your children. That doesn't mean that you're not in their lives. And even when you don't live with them, that doesn't mean that that's your fault. That's also a matter of judges giving children to women instead of men, regardless of whether or not they're deserving of it. That's just how is set up. In terms of some of the men, which again is not statistically significant, who don't mind it being in prison and see it as a rite of passage, the answer for that, in terms of the reason, is white people. They have, you know, conditioned men and just any of us to see criminality and jail and all of that and murder and fighting and all of that as masculine and as, you know, some bravado of some sort. And I also think, you know, that again, it's overblown. I don't think that, you know, most men in prison are happy about not being able to have sex and not being able to see their family and just go around and do and be free to do what they normally were doing. As far as the race soldier who was talking about, just last thing, as far as the race soldier who was talking about that we have, that there's racially profiling since we didn't get over slavery, that to me is just, even though she's supposed to be on our side, just using that language, she knows that this is not about racially profiling. This is about racism. This is about racism, and that's why I don't trust any whites, including John Brown. That may not have even happened. No, I'm lying. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
John Brown, the legend. The caller at 2262, if you had commentary, you should be with us.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you all. Hello, everyone. Caller, I'm calling from California. I'm in the middle of a workout, but I had a long, hard day on the plantation amongst other victims. But hearing the broadcast today, it really helped out. I'll just finish it by saying Black love is a revolutionary act, and white people are the problem. Thank you.
Much obliged. Great workout. Listening to the cows live during the workout. That's right on. Emmy would be proud. Other folks that I think we got all the folks that we've not heard from at all. So if you have a hand up and you have commentary you would like to share, proceed.
May I be heard? I spoke earlier, Gus. I just wanted
proceed.
To know if it was okay to... Okay, thank you. I just wanted to... This was from the first segment. There was some discussion of slave ships, and I had that... that came up with me a couple years ago because there were some people, you know, quote-unquote conspiracy theorists that were saying that, you know, there was no such thing as slave ships and maybe slavery never happened, you know, some craziness. So I thought to myself, they would never, never, ever call them slave ships. And when I lived in New York, I used to spend a lot of time in Battery Park. And there was this one ship, and it was called, I forget the name of the what it was commissioned as, but the type of ship it was called a schooner, S-C-H-O-O-N-E-R. And I said to myself, that looks a lot like a slave ship. So I started doing a little bit of research, and I pulled up schooners on the internet, and of course it came up with a bar and grill. Then I put in schooners from like 1700 to 1865. You will find a lot of schooners were used during the 1700s, and they'll tell you they were for moving, you know, tea and spices and things of that nature. But I believe that these quote-unquote schooners are the slave ships that we're looking for, but they're not calling them slave ships. A lot of them are preserved in many harbors these days, and they use them for tours and things of that nature. And they may have been restored because I think, like Scotty, Mr. Reed said earlier, they, you know, the wood deteriorates. But, you know, white people are good at restoring things, especially if it's a part of races of their racist history, and they're good at renaming them. So that's just something to consider. If anybody wants to do any research on schooners, it could be very possible that these are the slave ships that we're looking for. And that's all I had to say. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Other folks who had commentary period, proceed.
May I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, I think I got about 4 points I want to bring up. When she was talking about the slave traditions and talking about black and ugly and how you wouldn't catch a Japanese person saying that or a white person saying it. And then she went on to expound on black TV shows that are built around degrading other blacks. And I started to look at Sanford's son a little different. You know, he was constantly degrading Aunt Esther. And in reality, if you look into her background, she was a pretty attractive woman in her days. And she was very popular at one time. But anyway, the part about in spite of Katrina, we still think that white America would feed us. I think we probably have a little less black people that think that way after the way they did Puerto Rico. If they do them like that, what will they do to you? And there was a small riot in Baltimore, and the kids were throwing rocks at the police, and one of the mothers showed up on TV and grabbed her son and started to slap him down. And I remember that how the newscasters all praised her for beating her son on television. I guess he's about 16. And that she said was one of evidence of slave tradition. And the part about Thanksgiving and Christmas, I think we do best to practice the theory of non-participation. I know I do, because those are racist holidays. And one other thing, the part about the 200 separate slave revolts. I did not know that. I mean, approximately one revolt per year. Some of those that she listed on page 110, I did know about, and I actually looked up. But these are the ones commonly mentioned. Not, well, of course, I guess you could not record all the little revolts along the way. But I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Everybody, once again, greetings. I really appreciated the part in the book where she was talking about that she identified as slave traditions. Any time that you are impacted by a weapon, in this case, the weapon is the global system of racist white supremacy, it's going to have a result in effect. And she was, once again, scientifically explaining the effects, which is the name calling and the other abuse that is based on our confusion, which we impact upon one another. I thought that was very important. The book itself is alluding to be able to give information to other victims of racist white supremacy when they bring up the subject of racist white supremacy. This book would be a very good book into sharing information with that non-white person that may not know and or understand about the inner proponents of the global system of racism and white supremacy, what it is and how it works. I was especially attentive about the part about beating black children by quote unquote parents, black parents. I have always been conscious of that. I have an offspring, and I've made it my business to stay away from that type of interaction with him. I have made mistakes, though. as far as that, but for the most part, I've stayed away from physical or very harsh emotional interaction when he have made mistakes, and I would admit mine to him, especially in front of others, especially in front of white people, as far as that concerned. Also, the quote that she gave from Malcolm X, I thought was significant. That was, I believe, a part of the last quote-unquote major speech that he had before he was murdered. And he gave that particular quote within that speech. And the last but not least, the part on religion, I thought the quote that was in here, it sounds typically like the very shrewd but devious white person, and how they're able to use the religion, and I put emphasis on the religion of racist white supremacy, to convince non-white people by using deception, which is their main weapon, to be able to thoroughly abuse and mistreat people in the shrewdest scientific way by using deception. That passage that she gave on page 93, the lower part of 93, with the interaction between quote unquote slave owners and their slaves. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks that had commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be here?
Yes, Ivy.
Does she go since no one else did? No, I did a lot of talking. I just wanted to say sort of the conditioning. I don't believe that white people are conditioned. I think that they are the ones who do the conditioning, and what they have in terms of why they say what they say and do what they do is like that person who was on your program a long time ago, Robert L. Williams, that book that he had, that racism learned at an early age through racial scripting, that they just have these scripts, you know, what about black on black crime whenever racism is brought up. So they just default to these different scripts to justify their terrible acts. And, you know, I don't believe they have any guilt or anything like that as well, because they don't change. They tell jokes. And I love that she brought up the Tulsa, Oklahoma thing, because they also, they hung the business owners. And, the problem is not that that white people are turning us down for jobs, because who wants to work with a racist anyway? The problem is they're turning us down for licenses so that we can have our own businesses and work with each other and not be terrorized, plus businesses on trumped up charges, build freeways over them, bridges over them, playgrounds around them. And it just boils down to, you know, just not blaming us, just like she said about, you know, racism and thinking about the segregation thing. Dr. King and them, there's this thing about trying to blame them and saying that segregation is the problem. And they weren't trying to be around whites. They were just trying to have better schools and do whatever they could to improve their condition. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that thank you, Mr. Reed, for saying victims of slavery, because I was thinking slave victims, and I think just your wording is better. And I think that word kidnap, about kidnapping, well, I'll leave that alone. That was just great about that statement. And the last thing I want to say is that white people have a code of misconduct. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Indeed. Indeed. Did we have any other folks who had commentary they needed to get in?
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Las Vegas.
So thank you for allowing me to share. I'll be quick. I one of the things that I do appreciate about the book as well is like the little illustrations. She includes Sun Tzu's quote, basically about the enemy not allowing his enemy's will to be imposed on him, but the combatant, as it says, being able to impose his will on his enemy. So I definitely thought I appreciate that as well. And then just about the slavery traditions, I don't know how much I agree with, you know, I feel like it's definitely, you know, 50-50 as far as, you know, maybe some victims not wanting to be on the birth certificate, and then also some male victims not wanting to be on the birth certificate, and then also some female victims, you know, not wanting the male counterpart to be on the birth certificate. But the main thing is that just going back to why this all took place, and I feel like that's the one thing that we are not really understanding. You know, it's not, okay, well, it's just all one gender's responsibility or one gender's role, but also, you know, we can all, you know, be better. Another thing that I thought was significant was just the, I feel like when I first heard, when we first talked about doing the book, because I've never read it, and I guess I didn't know what to think of it. I didn't know that it would have so much historical notes in it. And that's definitely something that I appreciated and something that I was highlighting as far as, you know, reading some of the other books and stuff. And there was one the professor mentioned at the end at The Ohio State University. He actually has a book when it spoke, when she was referring to fact number 3 about the European Christians who were enslaved by Africans. So that's definitely something that I'm going to look into as well. And I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Las Vegas. Do we have any other folks? Anybody we missed? Grand. I will assume we got everyone. We will be back next Friday, picking up where we left off at. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review what's gone down past 7 days. There was an issue, tech issue, with uploading the archives to iTunes. The archive for the first study session, it's at Black Talk Radio Network. It's on SoundCloud. I think Mr. Fox has it at YouTube at this point. iTunes is the only place where I'm still trying to get it uploaded. Might be the same issue here until the iTunes problem is corrected, but the archive will be available. I'll make sure to share it on social media and what have you. So if you have any problems getting access to it, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. We will give Pamela Evans Harris the last word for the program. I'd said I was not going to comment at all for the book. I'm just going to push aside my time. That way we'll have more of Pam included as we read, and we should be able to get her talking specifically to points that were raised in the section of the book that we read for the week. So that's what we will do for this week. We'll give her the last word, and that will be the conclusion of the broadcast. This is Pam the Great, August 2011, just a few weeks after this book had first been published. And she's talking about one of the new modern classics, The Help, right in line with what we talked about today. Context of White Supremacy, Pam the Great.
And the church thing, and I don't mean to disrespect anybody, whatever religion or religious faith you have, but you really got to really ask yourself, why would the people that gave you this religion and told you to practice it in a certain way, how have they managed to keep you subjugated with that religion? And if that religion kept you subjugated and psychologically enslaved, should you not examine that religion to see if it is still performing the same function? Because I think it's significant that what you just said about them showing images of white Jesus in this movie about black women cleaning lazy white women's houses. And if you read some, and the thing is people think, well, cleaning houses, listen, if you read the stories of black women that worked in these homes, there's a book called Dry Long Soap. D-R is the word dry, then long, then soap. And it's a book that's still available on Amazon or online. And if you read the stories of the black women that worked in these houses, how they were treated by these white females that they worked for, the degradation, and a lot of times black women, black girls were raped in these houses by the men in those houses. If you read the stories, you will see there's nothing amusing or entertaining or enlightening about working in a lazy white woman's house. You are not part of the family. Sorry. You know, they try to portray it as you're just like one of the family. But if you're one of the family, how can I be one of the family when I leave your house? I'm still treated like a N-I-G-G-E-R. And you condone that. So my point is just that this is brain trashing. And when you see black people planking, this just shows you the psychological devastation that is happening under the system of white supremacy to people who do not understand the system of white supremacy, and particularly people who are sleeping with white people and do not understand the system of white supremacy. This is just psychological slaughter going on, that black people are paying money to be entertained by their own degradation and not even recognizing it. And if you ask the average black woman that's in that film, a black person that watches that film that enjoyed it, hey, you think that might be what it comes back to, that you're going to have to go in some white woman's house and clean it? I'll tell you no. Then you say, well, are you working? Are you employed? No. Okay, so at what point are you going to get hungry enough to go and clean a lazy white woman's house? That's a serious question, because the Mexicans are going home. Somebody's going to have to do some work, because I believe this society is moving to the point where they ain't going to pay you just not to work. They're not going to help you. There's not going to be a safety net. You're not going to sit at home because you're poor. And I'm not denigrating anybody poor, because I think people are poor because the system makes people poor. But you're not going to be sitting at home collecting benefits. They're going to make you work. Now, what kind of work? They're actually in Chicago. They're talking about making the prisoners in Cook County Jail working the dog pound. Free labor. They're talking about training prisoners to do all kinds of work. Free labor. They don't want to pay for anything now. What's next? Prisoners going off to war? You know, so I'm just saying, you know, you're watching the things change around you, and I don't think it's that far-fetched that some sisters are going to be, sisters or brothers, going to be in the house cleaning lazy white women's house if they want to eat. And I don't think that's far-fetched at all.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.